Welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa. I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with J.D. Trout, who is Professor of Philosophy and Psychology at Loyola University in Chicago. His new book, Wondrous Truths, The Improbable Triumph of Modern Science, is just out from Oxford University Press. The social practice we call science has had spectacular success in explaining the natural world since the 17th century, and that success shows no sign of abating. Advanced mathematics and other precursors of modern science were not all originally from or unique to Europe, but it was in Europe that the revolutionary advances in scientific knowledge began, where Isaac Newton, Robert Boyle, and others came up with theories that got modern physics and chemistry off the ground. Why Europe, and why then? And why do the answers to these questions have implications for scientific as well as philosophical views of the relation between scientific theories and the phenomena they explain? In his new book, Trout mounts a spirited defense of the claim that the best explanation of the rise of science in the 17th century Europe is that Newton and others got lucky. They happened to come up with versions of pre-existing ideas that were just right enough, just true enough, to explain just enough of the world. And that was enough to get the ball rolling. Trout defends the scientific realist view that scientific theories are successful because they are, by and large, true and not merely predictively accurate. He also sharply distinguishes the psychology of explanation, the aha feeling of understanding, from the truth of an explanation, arguing that while a feeling of understanding may be a useful heuristic, we can experience that feeling of being satisfied with an explanation when an explanation is false, and that conversely, there may be theories that are true that we will never really feel that we understand. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, J.D. Trout. Are you there?
I am. How you doing?
Hi. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thanks very much.
I'm glad to have you here to talk about your new book, Wondrous Truths, The Improbable Triumph of Modern Science, which, I mean, as the subtitle makes clear, it's sort of about how the rise of science in Europe in the 17th century with Newton and other scientists of that day was actually a bit of serendipity. It was sort of we lucked out in a way. But it's also an interesting exploration of the idea of the psychology of explanation, the feeling of aha and of understanding, and how that relates to the idea of what we understand actually being true. And so by that means to the whole idea and debate of scientific realism and the nature of explanation and the idea of explanation as being ontic, which is not a terribly popular view from what I understand. So it'll be interesting to know how you defend that particular view of explanation. So before we get to the actual content of the book, can you say something about your background as a philosopher and how you got to this particular topic and to the writing of the book?
Oh, sure. It depends on how far back you want me to go. I was always kind of interested in philosophical questions, having been raised as a Catholic kid and thought a lot about potential intellectual frailties of the doctrine of your religion. And we always had parish priests around for one reason or other who seemed to like to argue, so I would argue a lot with them. And I was usually looking for loopholes of one kind in doctrine, some way that you could get into heaven without really working hard or, at least get out of purgatory. And they usually indulged that kind of argument. And then in public high school, I had a teacher who happened to have been trained by the Jesuits, and he was really the one who introduced a lot of kids in the class to, really traditional philosophical arguments of Hobbes and Locke. And I really liked Anselm's ontological argument when I was, 15, 16, and started reading a lot of philosophy, but I was interested in everything. And then in college, I studied a lot of different topics, including philosophy of history, but also psychology, geology, I was really interested in. And I took a psychology course that did a lot of hands-on experimental demonstrations of sensory effects and perceptual effects. And a lot of what we were doing there seemed to me well-grounded in a way that a lot of the stuff that I had done in philosophy of mind was not. So it became harder and harder for me to see what philosophers were doing at a kind of intuitive and anecdotal basis to be a really firm basis for arguments, at least about the nature of the mind. And so when I went to graduate school at Cornell, I had kind of resolved to be at a place where the philosophy faculty would allow you to take whatever psychology courses you wanted, or any courses in the sciences, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. So it was a time at Cornell where, you know, Dick Boyd and Sidney Shoemaker and Robert Stalnaker were my committee members. And I had Frank Kyle, who was a psychologist, on my committee. And I took a lot of psychology coursework with Frank and with, at the time, Roger Shepard was visiting from Stanford. And a lot of the questions that I had were philosophically related, but the psychological phenomena were so gripping to me that I always approached them kind of as a psychologist, I guess. And I was able to follow two careers in a way at the outset of you know, my first jobs in philosophy. But I was always interested in history. I was always interested in the history of science. And the history of science to me was like what anthropology was to a lot of people. You know, it just transported you to some exotic land where people had, from your point of view, bizarre beliefs that, you know, seemed fantastic. And so I studied a lot of history of science and had an NSF predoctoral fellow in history and philosophy of science to linger over that material while I was doing experimental work as I completed my philosophy dissertation.
Okay. And then this particular book, did this come out of prior work or?
Well, it came out of my interest in realism. When I was in graduate school, Cornell was an easy place to be a realist. It was a nice place to be if you were a scientific realist. And I had written a book in the late 90s that took up the question of whether you could be a scientific realist about the social, the social and behavioral sciences. Mm-hmm. And whether there was a robust version of realism or a more modest version of realism that could be supported by what, you know, limited and constrained successes we could point to in theories of vision and theories of speech production and so on. And in fact, in that book, I looked at a lot of methodological issues of statistical significance testing. And a lot of those issues are alive now because of the replication project that is currently underway in psychology. Right. To examine the fidelity of a lot of putatively durable psychology findings.
Right.
So it came from a long interest that I had in scientific realism and the justification for belief in theoretical phenomena, mm-hmm. In the role of the history of science as evidence for particular philosophical theses about the rationality of scientific method.
Okay. So, well, I mean, that all does kind of come together. I mean, the book does, you know, it does bring together various supporting positions, right? One that you mentioned, scientific realism. You know, that's an old debate, which I want to talk about. But you start with, again, this mix of psychology and philosophy that has sort of characterized your professional career. You start with a look at the psychology of explanation. That's probably the best way I can put it, which is not it's sort of a new area, I guess, of inquiry, at least to me. And you explore the sense of that this experience we have, or sense we have of understanding something, and the satisfaction that we can feel at, you know, reaching that aha moment. So why don't we start with your discussion of the psychology of explanation? What is this sense of understanding? You know, what is it that's going on when we feel that, okay, we've reached an explanation that somehow is satisfying to us?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess I should begin by saying that the psychology of explanation is a kind of emerging topic in psychology as well as in philosophy. And, you know, it's owed in part to, you know, figures like Tanya Lombroso, mm-hmm. You know, who, you know, looks at the cognitive science of explanation. A lot of people in her lab and in her orbit. And, you know, in writing Wondrous Truths, I was kind of reacting to a lot of philosophy of science publication that increasingly became like Inside Baseball, where there were a set of narrow issues that people were interested in, that people would put a sort of twist on, and that was their own view. And I wanted this to be for a broader audience. So one way I approached the issue was that, you know, explanation is a really important feature of science, but it's also a feature that's familiar to ordinary people in their ordinary lives. There are reasons why people accept the explanations that they do, and those explanations aren't necessarily very arcane. But what we usually look for when we're deciding whether to accept an explanation is a sense of understanding that washes over us. So it's a kind of phenomenological experience that conveys a sense of coherence, or a sense of familiarity. Mm-hmm. You know, we look for that cue when we're trying to decide whether this is an explanation that we're going to accept. That's not to say that we don't accept explanations that don't carry that feeling. We just may be more deliberate about it. So it is a kind of sense of rightness or coherence. Psychologists have a lot of terms for this. Psychologists have studied things like feelings of rightness or feeling of knowing. Mm-hmm. They look at the fidelity of that feeling as a cue to whether you've gotten it right. So feelings of overconfidence or feelings of hindsight that lead to the inevitability feeling that you're right. Is oftentimes what drives both ordinary folks and scientists to accept the explanations that they do. So here's the sort of central puzzle that I try to face in the beginning of the book. If the sense of understanding that we get isn't a reliable cue to truth,
right?
So that the sense of understanding that you get from a good explanation could be the same kind of feeling that you get from a bad explanation. Just ask people for, you know, medieval figures for the feeling they got from, you know, bloodletting explanations.
Right.
Then how is it that we ever are able to orient ourselves toward approximately true theories? For a realist, that's a problem. Right, a realist wants to explain why science has been as theoretically successful as it appears to have been, and why it's had the instrumental successes that it's had. And if what drives us is a sense of understanding, mm-hmm. and that sense of understanding is not a reliable cue to truth, mm-hmm. how do we get oriented toward it?
Right. Although, wouldn't an anti-realist have a sort of a similar problem, even if they don't talk about truth? They would just talk about, you know, how do we orient ourselves towards theories that are more predictively robust? You can get the satisfaction, and it'll be predictively maybe enough, but the sense of satisfaction can similarly kind of outrun the predictability.
Right. I mean, for a social constructivist, it depends upon, you know, what your metaphysical scruples are. Mm-hmm. If you're willing to proliferate different theories and insist that, you know, you could have everything that you wanted, like the current science of the time or the most, you know, the current successful medical treatments of the time and, you know, engineering solutions at the time, no matter what your metaphysical view, then, you know, explanation may not be doing all that much epistemic work. Mm-hmm. And a constructive empiricist like von Frassen, I think, has less difficulty explaining some of the phenomena that I think realists have difficulty explaining, because a constructive empiricist can be more permissive about the empirical adequacy of multiple theories. So mm-hmm. if you're right. only looking for approximate truth at the observable level, there might be multiple theories that would provide that. And if you think that's enough to explain instrumental successes, then it may not depend on getting explanations right to have that instrumental success.
Okay, good. So, I mean, one of, as you just mentioned, I mean, we do have this, what you call a fluency heuristic, this idea that we have a sort of a phenomenological feeling that can drive acceptance, even when a theory is bad in the sense that it doesn't orient us towards truth. It feels good, but it's not true.
Right.
So how do realists sort of bridge that gap?
I think, you know, realists are realists about everything, hopefully, and so they're realists about the findings of mature psychological sciences as well. And in replicable and robust psychological effects that have been demonstrated about fluency show that we use it as a cue to truth, and under certain circumstances, it works just fine. Maybe those circumstances don't involve a lot of theoretical stress, but, you know, if you want, some of the research, in fact, on the epistemology of testimony makes this point nicely. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no problem in deferring to another person when you haven't personally observed something, as long as the stakes aren't high and there's no special reason to suppose that they're being deceptive or anything. Mm-hmm. In the psychological research on fluency, what you find is that people export this fluency cue to all sorts of domains where it turns out to be treacherous. So, uh-huh. We tend to process information that's familiar more quickly with less error. That is when it's on simple identification tasks. But people will also, for example, say that a statement is more likely to be true when it rhymes. And rhyming statements have a certain kind of fluency to them. So people report that statements like birds of a feather flock together is more likely to be true than statements like, you know, birds of a feather flock conjointly. Or suppose that it's more likely to be true when you say what sobriety conceals, alcohol reveals, compared to the non-rhyming correlate. So that fluency carries a kind of hedonic marking, a marking that gives us a kind of positive feeling. And there are, you know, similar kinds of fluency effects in related areas, like we show aesthetic preferences for objects that are familiar, even not just for familiar animals, say, you know, very prototypical animals of a category are more quickly and more reliably identified, but also artifacts like watch faces are found to be more aesthetically pleasing that are more familiar. So we process that information more fluently. What I argue in the book is that the same seems to be true of explanations. We plump for explanations that are familiar based on our background theories, And when people ask, well, why do we have this reliance on fluency? I suggest that, you know, one possibility is that, you know, we're arguably neophobic in a certain way. And humans are thought to be neophobic. Mm-hmm. They're slightly afraid of new things. And, you know, one reason for that might be that, you know, the preference for the familiar is that what we're familiar with hasn't killed us yet. Mm-hmm. So we show a preference for things that are a little bit familiar, and it slightly enhances our processing speed. It causes us to embrace those settings a little bit more fervently. And so we stick to familiar views. We're a little bit more conservative in the metrics we choose when we evaluate the plausibility or the credibility of particular hypotheses. You know, all at once, then, the fluency heuristic explains both the sense of understanding we get, that is, that positively hedonically marked feeling, and it explains where we might be getting it wrong when the progress of science delivers us to a point where we require arcane knowledge, where those ordinary heuristic cues may break down.
Okay, and I mean, this seems to be a very pressing issue right now in terms of in science communication, in terms of acceptance of theories like global warming and, you know, things that might clash with what we are familiar with and reluctant to accept new evidence of, you know, things that are happening that conflict with our prior beliefs.
Oh, absolutely. And I think actually the ontic account of explanation that I talk about in the book, in the middle part of the book, can illuminate some of what goes on in policy and in political settings. In the case of global warming, you know, you find members of Congress finding it very difficult to accept the idea of global warming, not just because their beliefs are motivated and they're compromised by lobbyists and campaign funders, which is no doubt true as well. Right. But also, you know, whenever it gets cold, they're less likely to suppose that there's such a thing as global warming. And and, you know, that's an effect that's found even in experimental settings. But you don't ordinarily find grown adults arguing against global warming by, you know, throwing a snowball on the congressional floor, which is one thing that happened in one of the science committee meetings. But one cause of that level of dispute is that it's difficult for people to imagine, even educated people, that sometimes there are arcane facts that resolve or that would resolve these disputes that they can't know about, that their training doesn't allow them to understand. And a regular high school and even college education does not prepare you to appreciate the kinds of details that establish theses like global warming.
So let me just explore before I do want to get to the ontic explanation, which you just mentioned. One of the interesting things that I thought about with the way you distinguished sort of the psychology of explanation, the reasons for acceptance, the familiarity, and so forth. Two things kind of occurred to me. One was, if, as I'm sure you remember, Thomas Kuhn was very, very sharply criticized when he argued that theory acceptance was not rational, or at least that was what he was accused of claiming, that it was just a matter of mob psychology. And so I was just wondering, on the one hand, if acceptance, on your view, is a similar sort of non-rational feature, maybe of the individual, if not the mob. And another thing I thought about was, well, if we're realists, then wouldn't we be better off trying to, you kind of set our computers as in fact some people have tried to do, to find the best theories, to generate, maybe generate lots of different possibilities and sort of do a generate and test kind of procedure, where you don't have this, you don't need a fluency heuristic to point you in the right direction towards truth. You have a computer which doesn't need that, and they can point us to the truth a lot better. So you avoid having to depend on a flawed heuristic to begin with.
Right. Yeah, no, there's a lot there. So let me take the theses one at a time. I don't really think that the discussion of fluency in, at least the way I conceive of it, I don't think it's tied to individual cognition. And as a matter of fact, I think if it's based on a kind of mild neophobia, that would be a species characteristic that drives us in a particular direction. Mm-hmm. The account of scientific progress that I ultimately give is filled with gaps and filled with idiosyncrasies. And, you know, in fact, I think that we need the kind of contingency account that I offer, in part because the history of science is otherwise so gappy when it's compared to the seamless picture that's provided in the first paragraph of an intro physics textbook for high school students, say. I think you could be quite Kuhnian in your conception of the forces that shape people's beliefs. And I think it's a general characteristic of people that they're driven to use some heuristic or other to decide whether to accept an explanation just because they have these human characteristics. So, you know, it's nicely that sort of human temptation is captured by Vonnegut in Cat's Cradle, you know, where he says at one point, one of his characters does, says, tiger got to hunt, bird got to fly, man got to sit and wonder why. Tiger got to sleep, bird got to land, man got to tell himself he understand. And so part of his point there is that, you know, we have this drive to do certain things. You know, we sit and wonder why. But just like the tiger has to sleep, and just like the bird has to land at some point, people have to tell themselves that they understand. They have to stop inquiring at a certain point and move. And, you know, William James talks about our efforts to reduce what he calls the peculiar unease of indecision. And so the stopping rules that we use for explanation, when we where and when we stop explaining something and decide that we're going to accept this, this finding, or, you know, count this as the final explanation, depends as much on motivational factors as it does on, you know, purely cognitive or epistemic ones. Mm-hmm. So that was the one point to respond to. The other one was your point about, you know, how it might be possible to have kind of formal systems that search for causes in the way that people do, but without the fluency heuristic. Mm-hmm. You know, so you could have a kind of formal system. I think that's actually right. I think that, you know, there's nothing nutty about that view. And as a matter of fact, John Bickel and colleagues of his have published on the topic of, you know, using those sorts of formal searches of causal discovery. In those cases, it, you know, it's impressive how much it helps to have at least some weak constraints on what can count as being causally relevant. But they're really, if my view is roughly right, there's really no reason why there can't be an alternative approach as well that, you know, works in a relatively automatic way through massive amounts of data looking for non-accidental correlations.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you mentioned the ontic view of explanation, where, you know, a good explanation is basically one that's true or approximates the truth or gets us closer to the truth. And in a sense, you know, understanding is kind of a separate issue. If we get there through a sense of, you know, an experience of aha or something, you know, fine. But if we can light, we the goodness of an explanation is distinct from whether we understand it or not.
Yeah.
And that hasn't been a particularly popular view. I mean, in my experience, or at least in my knowledge, and maybe I'm wrong about that, but I think Carl Craver at one point in one of his papers or books defended it, and then he later gave it up. But in any case, it's thought to be somewhat controversial. Mm-hmm. And so maybe you can say a bit more about the ontic view and give it a run for its money.
Sure. I think there are figures like Craver who have defended it in the past. There's, you know, Salmon had a version of ontic explanation. You can also see a drive for a certain kind of ontic explanation in some of Hempel's work, where, you know, he's sort of trenchantly critical of psychological factors and explanation. I think a lot of the reason that ontic explanation hasn't been all that popular is that there's not really a difference in substance. There's a difference in where practitioners draw the line between what's required for explanation and what's not. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people who don't like ontic explanation don't like it because they feel like explanation is essentially about understanding.
Right.
And, understanding has to be in some way crucially involved in cognitive successes or intellectual successes. As a matter of fact, when you even think about understanding something, or what we mean when we say that, you know, we understand something, it seems almost uniquely associated with a cognitive achievement of some sort. And it's usually a success verb. You know, we don't usually say we understand something, but I got it wrong.
Right.
You know, so what I would do if I were trying to include an account of understanding in my account of explanation would be simply to do what, say, causal theorists of reference did to description theories in the philosophy of language, which was, you know, to sort of start talking about the phenomenon of understanding as though it was an account of reliable regulation of some sort. Now, that would give you certain counterintuitive pictures of what understanding in ordinarily parlance implied. Mm-hmm. But it would have the virtue of including some aspects of understanding in a theory of explanation. So the ontic account, and, you know, as I mentioned, part of it was made current by Wesley Salmon, focuses on descriptions of causes, right? Mm. So rather than the psychological factors that would make explanations intelligible or in some other way acceptable, you know, so it honors the reason that we pursue explanations, that we want descriptions that are true. And usually those descriptions are causal descriptions. So if it's one thing to say what an explanation is, and for that I like something like Richard Miller's simple definition. It's a description of underlying causes that are sufficient under the circumstances to bring about an effect. That's the way he puts it. Mm-hmm. But it's quite another to say how we decide what explanations are the best, or at least good enough to press forward. So the ontic account is an effort to say what explanation is, and is an explanation that orients you toward the truth on that view. Mm-hmm. A lot of the factors that might contribute to that orientation may not be ones that are easily accessible to us, or that come easily to us in understanding them. Some of them may be so arcane that even highly trained people couldn't track the detailed causes. But in those cases, you would still want to say that the things that you don't understand are good explanations for what happened, I think. Mm-hmm. So that's the basic idea, is that, you know, the ontic account captures the causal aspect of explanation, the idea that what you want is accurate causal descriptions, but it separates it from lots of the psychological issues about, you know, whether or not the explanation is intelligible to an audience. Mm-hmm.
So let me pursue this in relation to a particular issue that's close to my heart in terms of philosophy of mind and the so-called explanatory gap, right?
Sure.
So there's the hard problem of consciousness. Depending on who you're reading, it's either we will never be able to explain it, you know, if you take a, you know, Mysterian view, or physicalism hasn't explained it yet, if you just kind of take a explanatory gap kind of view. But there is this idea that, qualia, conscious experience, either can't be or at least hasn't been satisfactorily explained in terms of, you know, neuroscience or some sort of physical stuff. Mm-hmm. So on your view, is the question that people in philosophy of mind are kind of all up in arms about, what is the problem in terms that you would put, what is the difficulty that we face with explaining the mind?
Yeah, I mean, I'm inclined to say that about consciousness, the array of views out there oftentimes have to do with this, either mistaken views about what's required for scientific defense. Sometimes it's an uninteresting artifact of philosophical impatience. You're presented with a qualia problem of some sort, and assuming that you have to solve that problem in order to be a good physicalist, to give a thorough account of, or a thorough ontological inventory of the universe, where qualia don't appear irreducibly, or else I'm going to be a dualist. And I think that doesn't get the right pattern of concept formation in these kinds of disputes. I would rather postpone decision indefinitely about these issues than to take what seems to be a drastic metaphysical view, in the short term. So, for example, I'd be prepared to say that we're cognitively bounded with respect to solving that problem before I'd say that dualism is true, mm-hmm. or that physicalism must be false because of some difficulty associated with the explanatory gap. We face all sorts of gaps, and granted, not all of them are qualitative. But in those cases, we have a little bit of intellectual modesty. And we say, this is a matter of evidence. And, the evidence isn't all in. And let's wait and see how things go. We might find increasing confirmation for physicalism as our neuroscientific theories improve, and we know what the brain is actually doing when processing, say, sensory information that is associated with qualitative experience. Mm-hmm. I would rather take that approach than take very seriously the pronouncements based on thought experiments when you really don't know how deviations from the ideal affect the model.
You do have an interesting discussion about inference to the best explanation, which is obviously related to your ontic view, the best one being the more true one, and induction in general, and efforts, again, in philosophical circles to claim that somehow IBE is a special sort of inductive inference or method of reaching an explanation. And you argue that essentially inference to the best explanation is inherent in all induction.
Right.
So can you say a bit about that?
Sure. Let me just back up for a moment and say that one reason why I talk about induction in the way that I do at the point that I do in the book is that I'm trying to argue against a certain textbook conception of how the history of science proceeded. Mm-hmm. And usually that story is kind of an empiricist story of the accumulation of observations where, you know, confirmation is a linear function of number of observations and, you know, you get an increase in the scope of a theory that gets stronger and stronger as time goes on. And that's how we landed in our current elevated intellectual situation. And the story that I tell is a lot gappier. You know, induction is a much more explanatory process. So one way in which I think induction is explanatory through and through is that when somebody is inclined to rely on inductive reasoning, all you would need to do is ask them why they think something like, you know, the straight rule is reliable or something like that. All you would need to do is ask somebody that in order to get some kind of answer that's largely explanatory, that's based on explanatory principles. So, you know, the person would be in a position to have to say, you know, as a sample size increases, if it's representative, then it will increasingly represent the distribution in the population. You know, that fact is not itself, you know, a fact about the accumulation of evidence. It's based on theoretical information that goes beyond observation that the population, that the sample is representative of the population. Mm-hmm. Now, this is not a new point. And, you know, people like Gilbert Harman argued that in his 1965 paper on enumerative induction. He says that even enumerative induction is based on certain kinds of explanatory principles. So the reason that I want to make that point to make induction appear as robust as it actually is that anti-realists who argue against realism will oftentimes argue by saying that or implying that abduction or inference of the best explanation is some kind of additional exotic aspect of inductive argumentation. Mm-hmm. And my point is that there's nothing additional about it. It just happens to be about issues that are intellectually more aggressive. You're not just talking about modest methodological issues about, you know, whether the sample mean is a reliable estimator of the population mean. You're talking about something much more robust and theoretical, but it's not an exotic type of reasoning. It's just ordinary old inductive reasoning that's based on explanatory principles.
So let me ask about your defense of this idea that the spectacular rise or success of science since approximately Newton and Boyle and people in that era. There's a sense which you kind of alluded to in which the explanation is sometimes given that you know, it was a matter of following the scientific method, you know, sort of more, basically a more rational kind of process that led to this. And you argue that the best explanation of the rise of science in Europe at the time that it did in the 1600s is serendipity, basically, is that Newton got lucky. He happened upon a version of the corpuscularian theory, which, you know, and of course atomism had been around for thousands of years in some form,
right?
Since Democritus, right? And you know, so the idea of all of matter being made of little tiny invisible items was not in itself new, and it was resurrected as the corpuscularian theory, but there were particular aspects of the corpuscles that were close enough, you know, by luck, to the truth that they enabled Newton to come up with or implement, you know, the laws that he did in a way that was, you know, reasonably also reasonably close to the truth. In fact, for many years, we did think that his laws were strictly true. Mm-hmm. So can you say a bit about this alternative explanation of the success of science?
Sure. And, you know, I should say that my explanation doesn't deny that science progressed in part from, especially during Newton's time, narrowly construed, by a certain kind of, joyless hard work that involved close experimentation. I mean, that's what the period of the air pump was about. That was what the period of, you know, tests of the composition of the air was about, the construction of vacuums and so on. But it is to say that that process from the late 1500s and later alchemy to Newton's time was theoretically very gappy, and that you can see around the time of Boyle, for example, before Newton, that Boyle's laws began to apply relatively well to what were the very late stages of corpuscular alchemy. You know, so, you know, you have to keep in mind that von Helmont, who was a chemist and alchemist at the time, I don't know whether you could call him a chemist really, and I don't think it matters one way or another, but he was one of Boyle's mentors. And, you know, Boyle speaks glowingly about him and all that he learned from him. But von Helmont was also an alchemist. And I think this sort of gold standard on this topic is Atoms and Alchemy by William Newman, where he makes a number of these points about the relationship between alchemy, late alchemy, and Newtonianism. But it's important to keep in mind that, you know, people that Boyle saw himself as having inherited tradition from held very peculiar views about the nature of corpuscles and the way magnetism works. So there's a famous passage in von Helmont's written work where he says, you know, if some ne'er-do-well defecates on your doorstep, you can punish him by slapping a hot iron on the feces. Oh. And by the mechanism of dorsal magnetism, he says, render the impudent's buttocks scabby. Right?
could you translate that for me?
So, you know, it's an amazing passage. It's, you know, the expression dorsal magnetism, like so much of the theoretical vocabulary of alchemy, appears nowhere else. And so one way in which the tradition leading up to Newton was contingent, was idiosyncratic, and, you know, very gappy, was that, you know, there were rises and changes in social norms at the time that made it easier to coordinate vocabulary across what Kuhn would have called paradigms. So, you know, at about the same time, there was the rise of the Paris Academy. We were left with a tradition from alchemy where nobody coordinated vocabulary. There were Arabic versions of alchemy that, you know, weren't looking for the same things that the continental European versions of alchemy, the Northern European versions of alchemy were looking for. And they used different vocabulary. They had different purposes. But in the late 1500s, the version of alchemy that involved a corpuscular thesis characterized the items as approximately spherical and hard. And so you could anticipate or predict certain kinds of interactions. At about the same time, you know, Daniel Sennert was doing really interesting experiments that, you know, sort of presupposed experimental design, where he'd run solutions through filter paper and then reconstitute compounds from the solutions. And those things would precipitate out from the solution, And he could show that whatever it was that made up those now visible items inside the solution were so small that they originally went through the filter paper. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there must be some physical properties of those items that combined in various ways according to certain regularities in order to make, macroscopic objects. So the Newtonian insight that the world in the small was something like the world in the large along the dimension of, you know, roundness and hardness and its elasticity and so on, played an important role when Boyle applied laws to those objects and created models on that basis, and then moving to Newton, the same was done.
Okay, and I mean, Newton himself, of course, you know, sort of famously or notoriously did a lot of alchemy himself, from what I understand.
Right. I mean, Betty Jo Dobbs was the first serious scholar to explore Newton's alchemy. And not just alchemy, but related theories of the occult.
So let me ask about the realism, anti-realism debate in particular. I mean, the usual argument, I mean, you're defending realism, scientific realism. Our theories are true or approximately true. And the one of the standard defenses for that is obviously the success argument or you know, that the truth of a theory is what explains its success. And then kind of hurling back at the anti-realists, it's like if you don't think that the theories are approximately true and that's why the theories are and science itself is so successful, you know, basically you make the success of science a mystery. So as I read your book, and I was trying to understand this, the role of contingency, and there's more to be said about that. So I do want to ask that, because you give a number of, you know, like six different ways in which, you know, hitting on the right theory is contingent. It struck me that by giving such a large role to contingency, among other factors, you know, essentially that's a way of saying that, you know, realism itself is to be a realist is sort of a mystery. There's still a mystery perpetuated there, except now it's just a matter of we lucked out rather than you have no explanation, right? So can you explain your version of the success argument?
Sure. I think, you know, there's a kind of, people sometimes try to understand arguments for realism as though they're, fine-tuning arguments of some kind. I just think that the history of science has so many conceptual, historical, cultural, environmental, you know, temporal gaps in it that, many of the most important discoveries are going to necessarily be idiosyncratic, unprecedented, surprising. On the one hand, those are the contingencies that I think people find really shocking about large movements forward in the history of science, that, Watson and Crick were really lucky to have had an X-ray crystallographer who happened to be in the Carroll right nearby. Mm-hmm. You know, those sorts of contingencies may matter. But if your explanation is a realist explanation, there's one degree of freedom that's much more limited, that's much more constrained, according to a realist, than, say, a constructivist or an empiricist. And that's that realists are much more willing to say that that contingency is constrained by the fact that the world rudely intervenes when we're mistaken under continued efforts to expose what the world is like. So, you know, the realist basically takes the observation that we often stub our toe in the dark and generates from that the fact that if you're working hard, experimenting, and your theories get good enough, it's not just not accidental that you land on some good theories. It's over time very probable that you will. Maybe not inevitable, but very probable that you will. So actually, far from thinking that the success of science is contingent but somehow irreducibly accidental, if you combine the generation of ideas that are rich and diverse through all of these different circumstances that are very contingent, psychological, environmental, and so on, it increases the probability that you're actually going to land on a good theory. And when you do, it's less probable that you're not going to recognize it, because the good theories will typically have good instrumental consequences that outcompete others.
So is the role of contingency or serendipity, is that the explanation there of the sort of the historical geographical fact of, you know, when and where modern science kind of took off? And
yes.
Then later on, it's like, you know, once you get the ball rolling, then, yeah, serendipity is never completely off the scene, obviously. I mean, people, you know, wave, I think it was Hubble and Weisel, you know, were looking at some neurons and one of them knocked a slide and one of the neurons kind of, you know, just went nuts. And this was how they kind of realized that it had a particular receptive field for, horizontal lines at a particular angle. I mean, it was completely accidental. So
right.
Those sorts of things happen all the time, but your role of accident is more just, you know, we want to explain why was it that, you know, at that point in time, several hundred years ago in Europe, you know, why did science take off then and there, as opposed to all the other places it very well might have, given the advances in mathematics and the alchemy and all these other things that were also happening in other places in the world. Is that correct?
I think that's exactly right. You know, there were small effects in the history of science, like the kinds that you talked about, during periods that Kuhn would have regarded as normal science. And those have contingencies too, but the effect sizes are small. If you're trying to explain why science took off when it did, what scientific realists call mature science, this goes back to, a really nice 1980 paper of Richard Boyd's, where he's talking about the sort of classic argument about what came first. Was it the reliability of scientific methodology or approximate truth of a theory? And I think the only defense that a scientific realist can give that's systematic and plausible is one that cleaves to the contingency, the radical epistemic contingency of the history of science, that for whatever contingent reasons, we hooked on to an approximately true account of the universe, and or at least our corner of it, and that, you know, a really important area of science took off that in our efforts to unify apparently disparate domains then helped other sciences to do the same.
Okay. We're running out of time. I have this a quick question about the book that I did want to ask was, you do give a sort of an argument or series of arguments against the anti-realist, you know, the general challenge that, you know, we can't know that the best theories are true. It's just a, it's basically, it's a metaphysical leap of faith that we don't need to make. And you make the point that, in a sense, the anti-realists tend to be very selectively skeptical about, you know, when they're criticizing realism. So can you say something about that and the what you call this the seeping consequences of anti-realism?
Sure. Philosophers of science, in particular empiricist philosophers of science, will oftentimes run underdetermination arguments. As a result, those arguments highlight the possibility that, the appearances could have been produced by many other causes. But that's all too facile. Mm-hmm. And you have to be willing to pay a price for being selectively skeptical about the things about current theories that you're prepared to revise. So, you know, it's very difficult to be selectively skeptical, say, about radiometric dating, as certain kinds of creationists might be, for example. But if you're selectively skeptical about one particular area, like radiometric dating, then you have to be skeptical about the reasons that we think that there are parent elements and daughter elements, which raises questions about the nature of radioactive decay. And if you want to raise doubts about that, then you're also raising physical doubts about the basis of atomic theory. So you would similarly likely have some associated doubts about the reliability of things like atomic clocks and the oscillation of a cesium atom. There are all sorts of seeping consequences to introducing a selective doubt. And at a certain point, it doesn't just affect what other sciences you think are reliable. You can't even explain why your toaster works. So if you are selectively skeptical as an empiricist about whether we have knowledge about unobservable phenomena, I think you can do that, and that's fine, but you should be consistently skeptical about the item whose characteristics you're doubting and explore as many consequences as possible of the things that would be interrupted or the things that you would then come to doubt if you believe that radiometric dating is unreliable. Then what consequences does that have for, say, radioactive tracers that are used for CAT scans that identify and locate tumors? And would you be willing to go, say, to a vet rather than a doctor if you have a lump?
Yeah.
So you know, there are practical consequences to selective skepticism, as well as just theoretically seeping consequences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm trying to channel, you know, Bas von Franzen a little
right,
bit.
And, right.
You know, I don't think something tells me he would not be persuaded. For the simple reason,
he's smart enough to not be immediately persuaded.
Right. So. Well, he would not start with the toasters or the radioactive. He would start, you know, from the very bottom stuff, and, you know, kind of say, yeah, that's the stuff, you know, the very basic fundamental, you know, unobserved or unobservable, you know, items that to which we make this metaphysical leap. And then he would say something like, well, you know, we have these really great predictive theories, and that's really all we need to do. And because we can rely on those theories, we can rely on the other higher level theories about radiation and CAT scans and toasters. So it's sort of, I think he or somebody who's defending that would reject the idea that their skepticism is so selective. That might be true of particular religious fundamentalists who don't want, you know, to believe in, you know, carbon dating or something like that. The Earth is 8,000 years old or 6,000, so you're going to selectively say that radioactive dating doesn't work. But that's not the way, I don't think, that von Franzen or other anti-realists would go.
Well, I think that kind of reply is almost immediately beset with the traditional conjunction problem objection, you know, that when somebody has a favored theory that's very basic about, say, you know, some corner of the basic physical universe, you know, when scientists conjoin theories, von Frassen says at one point they have to be very careful to make sure that the theories that they're conjoining don't conflict or aren't inconsistent. But the fact is, you know, scientists oftentimes conjoin theories that they're not an expert in. So, you know, one person in one field may, who's in chemistry, may conjoin their theory with a theory in biology or vice versa to find out something about membrane biology. And they're not an expert in the other field. So it makes it look somehow very fortuitous that the unobservable stuff is hooked up in the right kinds of ways where it's not just superficially conjoined at the observable level, but also that the predictions and explanations for their successful conjunction seem to come from a confluence of the unobservables as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we are, I think we are out of time now. So I do want to end with a final question about what plans you have next. Are you working on another book or continuing in a similar similar vein of research, or are you turning off into a new direction? What's next for you?
Well, I'm working on a the Romanel lectures, the Phi Beta Kappa lectures that I did in 2013 that should be published, and I'm also working on a psychology of language book that's really like a fun book for everybody, I think, or at least I hope it will be. That looks at all of the really interesting and gripping language phenomena in running speech that characterizes it just as an elaborate and delicate choreography. Hmm. So I hope to sort of capture some of the magic of language by framing the questions in that way in short and accessible phenomena.
Hmm. Very good. Well, that all sounds very interesting, but we have to end for now. So I just wanted to thank you again for taking the time to talk with New Books in Philosophy about your new book.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. It was great.
You've been listening to my interview with J.D. Trout. We've been talking about his book, Wondrous Truths, The Improbable Triumph of Modern Science, which is just out from Oxford University Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.